All right. Yes, in fact, it is an honor to be here today to tell you about LBVs and possible connections to these luminous supernovae. That's basically the title of my, or the outline of my talk. I'll do a brief summary of some of the properties of LBVs, and then I'll go on and talk about how they may be related to these luminous supernovae through circumstellar interaction. This will be sort of an amalgam of insights that I've come to based on a variety of, or work with a variety of collaborators listed here on the bottom. You'll notice that there are two tiers here. There's a several, well, you probably recognize most of these names, and the ones on the top are sort of older, and the ones on the bottom are sort of younger, which reminds me that 60th birthday celebrations are a time not only when you look back to your own accomplishments, but you also look back to the younger generation, in the words of Spitzer, who is going to be trying to fill your footsteps. If you were in the vicinity or within earshot of the Best Western last night, you may have come to worry that the future of astronomy may be in jeopardy. However, these people were actually working very hard. This is a 3D hydrodynamic simulation of hot bottom burning in a degenerate core. Okay, so LBVs, LBVs are basically the most, when you look at any galaxy, there's the most luminous hot stars that we see. And where we think they come from is that you start with the most massive, hottest O stars evolve off the main sequence. And they do two things. They become more luminous with time because their cores are contracting. And they also become, they lose mass with time. They're shedding mass through stellar winds. And so their luminosity to mass ratio ends up going up. And so that means they're getting closer to the classical Eddington limit. And you expect that as they get closer and closer to the classical Eddington limit, that various types of instabilities might begin to become more important. It becomes easier to disrupt the star the closer you are to that limit. That's especially the case when you consider the fact that these things are now moving to the right, and they're getting cooler as well, which means that opacity starts to become important because it's not only that now the classical Eddington limit, but opacity-modified Eddington limit. And now we don't know what causes these outbursts. We do not know what triggers them, but we know observationally that the luminosity does go up and the mass loss rate does go up. And so one of the formats, one of the ways we talk about these things is in the context of super Eddington continuum-driven winds. And this comes about because the mass loss rates that we measure are way too high, factors of 1,000 too high above what you can possibly explain with line-driven winds, because the lines that you drive the wind with become saturated. These are mass loss rates of a percent of a solar mass per year or more. So we talk about continuum-driven winds and continuum-driven outbursts. Also, they could be possibly some sort of hydrodynamic explosion. We don't know. But the point that we've tried to make, especially in this paper with myself and Stan Iwaki, is that in either case, it's the mechanism by which you drive the material off the star is not sensitive to metallicity. If it's a continuum-driven wind or if it's some sort of pulsations, the method by which you launch this material does not depend on metallicity, and therefore it might be important over a range of metallicities in determining the fates of massive stars. And so what you end up with, the type of supernova you end up with, depends on how you incorporate this mass loss, because the mass budget tells you that these stars, the most luminous stars, lose more mass sometimes in a single outburst that lasts 10 years than they do in their entire lifetime on the main sequence. So this is to remind us that this is an observational class of stars, that we know these happen. Again, we don't know why. They've been around for a long time. We've studied them in detail. They used to be called Hubble-Sandage variables. They were discovered in the 50s, or first sort of discussed as a group in the 50s. Each one of these stars, you know, has five or a dozen people who spend their career studying that one star. They're very bright. R127, for example, is the most luminous star, or the visually brightest star in the LMC. And one point that I really want to get across that you can see from this plot is that when people think of LBVs, they think Eta Carinae, the most massive stars. But in fact, we see the LBV variability, the behavior, over a very large range of masses, a range of 6 or 7 in initial mass. The stars down here, which are also LBVs, get down to 20, 22 solar masses. Now, that's the lower bound of what we what we really classify as an LBV, and that comes from an observational criterion, which is that when they're not in outburst, they tend to sit along this line here called the S-Doradus instability strip. And then they undergo irregular outbursts where for maybe 5 years or 10 years, they'll go across the HR diagram, all at the same temperature, and then after another 5 or 10 years, they'll go back. Now that's different than the other phenomenon that's also associated with LBVs, which are the giant eruptions, when these stars increase their bolometric luminosity by a factor of 10 sometimes, and they'll eject a solar mass or 10 solar masses within a couple of years. And those are more rarely observed, of course, but we see evidence for them because we see massive shells around these stars. And those shells could not have come from swept up red supergiant winds, because there's a very well-determined upper limit above which there are no red supergiants in any galaxies. No one's ever seen a red supergiant above 10 to minus 5.8 solar luminosities, and they would be easy to see. So the idea is that these stars evolve to the right and they lose their mass through LBV outbursts instead of red supergiant winds. Presumably that's how they end up becoming Wolf-Rayet stars, and if they can't make it, they'll explode first. Now, it's quite possible that the giant eruptions that we see are not really the result of the same instability that causes these oscillations. In fact, they might be unrelated. That giant outburst might have something to do with the evolution in the core of the star. And that sometimes we think that must be the case, because some of the more extreme events involve 10 to the 50 ergs and 10 solar masses. And that's basically the whole envelope of the star. And it actually digs down into the convective core. So if we don't have an explanation for this, but these giant outbursts happen over a huge range of masses down to about 20, where we associate them with LBVs, we don't necessarily have a reason to think that they won't continue down to lower luminosities as well. But that's another topic. When we look at, if it advances, the plot of the mass of these shells that are around these stars that are typically 1,000 years old, we can see that, Eta Car is not, it does not really stand out. We look at these other LBVs and they have 10-ish solar masses in these shells that were ejected fairly recently. And there seems to be an upper threshold to this that is vaguely luminosity dependent and suggests that the energy and mass involved in the outburst somehow depends on the initial mass of the star. This color here is the upper luminosity limit for red supergiants. So these shells could have originated in swept up red supergiant shells, but these can't. And again, I want to emphasize the fact that there is a range. One good way to do that is with P Cygni. It's a famous star. Everyone's heard of P Cygni profiles. This star was observed to have an outburst. It's in our galaxy. The outburst was seen in 1600 AD. It also increased its bolometric luminosity for a number of years. And now when we look at it, we see a shell around it. The shell has a few tenths of a solar mass. And an interesting comparison between this and Eta Car is that this one is not bipolar. People sometimes talk about mergers for these things. This is a spherical shell. And again, like Eta Car, you'll see in a second, or in a few minutes, this one also has an older shell that was ejected probably 1,000 years before, based on the expansion, the Doppler shifts that we see. And so the kinetic energy involved in this one was a few times 10 to the 47 ergs. The speed was a little bit slower than Eta Car, but it's a less extreme example of what we think is a similar phenomenon. Now, transitioning to the topic of LBVs exploding. LBVs are not supposed to explode based on stellar evolution theory. We're always told that they are a very brief transitional phase between the end of core hydrogen burning and the beginning of core helium burning. So we would be surprised if we saw an LBV explode. But this is, of course, not the first time that we've been surprised to see blue supergiants explode. And this is an interesting connection, again, with LBVs, because we've looked at LBV nebulae in our galaxy, and we see some that look astonishingly like the nebula around supernova 1987A. And the interesting thing here, this star is an LBV. It's not in a binary, as far as we can tell. People have been studying it for years. We have lots of high-resolution spectra. And it's not an extremely rapid rotator, either. It's rotating, but not terribly fast. So it's probably not the product of a merger. So the conclusion is that in this case, perhaps the shell around 87A originated in something similar like this, which is a great relief. So we were no longer so astonished to see that. This was, could have also been many AAS cocktails that relaxed us. So Avishay mentioned 05GL. This one is connected to the P-Cygni that I talked about because the peak luminosity, the luminosity of the star before the outburst, and the mass of the star, about 50 solar masses, as well as the mass loss rate for the progenitor star that you derive from the luminosity of the circumstellar interaction, which I'll talk about in a second, match those of P-Cygni. So this was sort of a moderate luminosity or low luminosity type 2N supernova. And this observation that the star, the progenitor star, was probably an LBV supports this idea that there's a connection with LBVs. And in fact, I'm showing this from my own paper. We got a little bit higher resolution spectrum, enough that you can see the narrow P-Cygni absorption in H-alpha. And I would argue that from this, we would have, even without this information, we'd have concluded by the same arguments we use for the other ones, that this might have been an LBV. So this observation really helps establish that to make the connection with the other claims we make where we don't have a progenitor, that those are probably LBVs as well. So circumstellar interaction. We see type 2N supernovae with a huge diversity of luminosity and a diversity of spectral properties. But the basic idea is that the star explodes and the shock runs into material that was ejected by the star before the supernova. Now, in order for that shock to hit this stuff in the first 100 days or so after the supernova, it must be pretty close. In fact, we think we can measure the speed of the progenitor wind because we see the speed of the progenitor of the narrow P-Cygni absorption. And so we can figure out the time when it was ejected. And it is typically within decades or 100 years before the supernova. So this tells us that these stars were doing something shortly before exploding, and then there's a range of mass loss rates. That luminosity that you see from the shock interaction should be proportional to the mass loss rate of the star. And from the observation of the speed of the blast wave from the intermediate width profile, and the observation of the speed of the progenitor wind from the narrow P-Cygni absorption, and of course the luminosity of the supernova, you can calculate what the mass loss rate should have been. And you end up requiring very high mass loss rates, even for a luminosity of only 10 to the 9, which is, you know, sort of like the peak of a normal type 2N. In order for the circumstellar interaction luminosity even to compete with a normal photosphere of a 2N, you need a mass loss rate of a few tenths of a solar mass per year, which is much higher than you can get from any normal stellar wind. So these more luminous events require us to think about, made us think a little bit harder about the engines that we can use to drive them. So Dick McCray and I wrote this paper. It's a pretty simple model. We wrote it while on a bike ride in the Netherlands, where the shock wave plows into an opaque circumstellar shell. Now this differs, well, it's basically the same as a type 2P or type 2L supernova, except here it's a circumstellar, an unbound circumstellar shell, and that allows us to get a very large initial radius so that when you deposit the thermal energy, it can be radiated before the whole thing expands and cools adiabatically. And from that type of diffusion-powered supernova, you would expect to see something like a 2P or 2L spectrum. You wouldn't expect to see the narrow emission. And I think that's probably a good bet for these really luminous supernovae that aren't type 2Ns, like 05AP and 08ES. Now, there's no reason why you can't have more material out there. If there's more material out there, first of all, it'll be irradiated by the supernova, and you'll probably see a narrow line from the pre-shock circumstellar gas. And in addition, as this shock now continues to plow into more material, this you could generate additional luminosity. And I think that's probably, if you have both of these together, that's probably how we get the very luminous type 2Ns. If you don't have a very optically thick diffusion-powered light curve from the inner shell, then it'll just be a normal type 2N, some of the less luminous type 2Ns. And some evidence for this comes from looking at the H-alpha equivalent width. It turns out that the more luminous supernovae, like O6 TF and O6 GY, have progressively lower H-alpha equivalent widths. In other words, the luminosity, the absolute luminosity in H-alpha of all these things is very similar. But the more luminous ones seem to have more of a contribution from some continuum source, which is probably the diffusion from the optically thick shell. And so if you want to see some details about this, there's a paper on, that should be 2008, on 2006 TF, where we discuss this transition from optically thick to optically thin, because they all, you see all of the two ends sort of, they increase their equivalent width with time. So we've been playing around with this a little bit, trying to get a feel for what sorts of light curves you can get by shocking circumstellar shells. Now, these aren't terribly realistic. They're not meant to match any observations. We're just playing with basically this. You launch a supernova into a circumstellar shell and see what light curve you get. In this case, the sharp edge is simply caused by the supernova running into outrunning the edge of the shell, so it drops. But it doesn't have to. If you have more mass, it'll continue to go down. We're just looking at sort of the dependence of what happens when you increase the mass of the shell. And it turns out to get up to the luminosities that are involved in some of these luminous type 2n supernovae, there's no way you can do it without having 10 or 20 solar masses in the shell. You need to put that much mass in front of the blast wave in order to decelerate it, in order to make a radiative shock so it can cool and collapse and radiate away the kinetic energy. Now, you can get a variety of light curves depending on where you put this shell. If you make it a slower shell or you eject it very shortly before the supernova so that it's more compact, you can take these light curves and sort of compress them. So you get a higher luminosity, but only for a short time after the supernova, but for a similar mass of 5 or 10 solar masses. And so this is probably more, this type of situation is more like the most luminous supernovae, the ones that don't have the type 2n spectrum, because in this case, this is a very simplified model. We had instantaneous cooling from the shell, but in fact, if it has to radiate that much energy that fast, it'll probably, you'll find that diffusion is important. Now, one of the things we can do from this is simply add up the total radiated light in visual light, and then compare that to the energy of the explosion that we put into the model and derive an efficiency. And you find basically that the efficiency is proportional to the mass of the shell divided by the total mass involved in the explosion. And so because we can observe the speeds of the shell as this thing is expanding, we can sort of try and infer something about the mass of the supernova as well based on the momentum conservation. But the main point is that from just by varying the radial distribution and density and amount of mass in the shell, we can get a huge variety of light curves that come pretty close or can approximate the distribution of luminosities and lengths of light curves that we see in 2N. Sometimes we see things that show circumstellar interaction for a long time. Supernova 1988Z is still going. Whereas sometimes we see them as a 2N and then they drop off very sharply, probably because something reached the outer edge of the shell. And so again, up here, when we start getting up in this regime, we see this business about the H-alpha width equivalent width, the narrow equivalent width, sort of depending on how much of the energy comes from diffusion and how much of it comes from ongoing circumstellar interaction. So we can now ask, again, we compare the sorts of masses and mass loss rates and speeds of the progenitor mass loss that we need for 2Ns and say what types of stars that we know about, observed stars in our galaxy and nearby galaxies, what stars can do this. And it turns out that any examples of stars with steady stellar winds don't even come close. In order to begin to achieve the circumstellar interaction luminosity that can compete with a normal plateau supernova or more, we need mass loss rates that are much higher. And so here I've shown several supernovae for which we can determine, in some cases, we can determine the expansion speed of the progenitor wind. In some cases, it's just a guess. And the mass loss rate you would need to power that luminosity. And the only things that really can account for these luminous supernovae, not just the magnitude of how bright they are, but also the distribution, the range of mass loss rates, are LBV eruptions. The only exceptions are these things like 2005 IP, which was among the lowest luminosity type 2Ns. It just kind of stayed flat here for a while. And that could be, if you notice, from a red supergiant wind, like VY Canis Majoris or IRC 10420. But these are the absolute most extreme red supergiants that we know about. I mean, they're losing mass at about 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per year. They have masers in them. The star's obscured. we don't see any other cool stars with higher mass loss rates. And the reason that they can compete and achieve high levels of circumstellar interaction is because their winds are slow, so the winds are denser. All right, so let's take a little bit of a close look at O6GY and Eta Carinae. So Eta Carinae has a shell around it that was ejected in the 1840s. It's about 10 solar masses, maybe 15 solar masses. We know that from the infrared dust mass. And we know it's expanding at several hundred kilometers per second, and it's following a range of ejection speeds that are proportional to the distance from the star. In other words, it's simply in free expansion. It's homologous expansion. But in addition, it's surrounded by multiple outer shells that go out to a light year or two light years that are a few thousand years old, 1 to 2,000 years old. It probably wasn't the star Bethlehem in one of these previous eruptions, but the shells are of order 2,000 years old. So those shells are comparable in mass, several solar masses. When we look at O6GY, several people have studied this now, and we all seem to come to agreement that it's a 10. If it's powered by circumstellar interaction, it must be 10 or 20 solar masses of circumstellar material in order to have this cold, dense shell radiate away the energy. But we can do some more interesting things as well with O6GY, because we can study how the progenitor wind evolves, or how the absorption from the progenitor evolves as the shock moves outward. So if you think about this, as the forward shock is overtaking the progenitor wind, it's sweeping it up and eating it into the shell. And we see the absorption getting weaker with time, the narrow absorption. You see it going away as this thing fades. But in addition, it's not just fading, it's also that the case that the slowest absorption fades first, so that the velocities we see go to more blue-shifted speeds. And if we plot those velocities as a function of what we infer for the radius of the shell, guess what? We find that it vaguely matches a Hubble flow. And it implies that the outburst occurred 8 years before the supernova. If it's 10 or 20 solar masses, it's a 10 to the 49 or explosion. and pretty closely matches what Eta Carinae did in 1840. But there's more. Everyone wanted to know what this thing would do, you know, a year after. Would it continue to fade at the cobalt decay rate or not? Turned out it disappeared in the optical, but it stayed bright in the infrared. And in fact, in the optical, it had no sign of ongoing circumstellar interaction. But the luminosity in the infrared we proposed was caused by an infrared echo, where the luminosity emitted during the peak is now radiating a dust shell out at a radius of a light year. But in order to get the luminosity of dust that we see, we need about 5 to 10 solar masses of dust. So 2 years later, we've continued to look at this. You can see more about this on a poster by Adam Miller. The infrared echo continued, and it stayed luminous for more time, so we need a little bit more mass. When we look with HST, we now see, instead of a very red source, see the source is extremely red because the dust is cool. That's thermal emission from dust. In the optical, what we see probably is reflected light because it's very blue. It's as blue as the bluest stars in the galaxy. And in fact, if we take the emitted spectrum that we observed during peak luminosity and reflect it with a scattering law of lambda to the minus 1.2, it matches sufficiently well the photometry. So this implies that O6GY, this is very important, O6GY must have had another 10 or 20 solar mass shell out at a radius of about a light year, ejected 1,000 years or 2,000 years before the supernova. So it did it twice, just like Eta Carinae. And the time scale is very similar. So I didn't say much about the parent stability or the pulsational parent stability. We'll hear that in Stan's talk next. But the pulsational parent stability gives a pretty good count of the amount of mass and energy involved. But the the fact that this repeats is possibly has some consequences for that. So I'll just leave you with these final thoughts. The most important thing is that the LBVs, they don't just match the extreme amount of mass that we need for the bright two ends, but they have a range of mass loss rates that matches the range of mass loss rates needed for the two ends. So that's what I mean by the diversity of the circumstellar material. and maybe I'll, if you want to ask about this, I can speculate, but during the question session, but okay, that's basically it. Thanks.
Since you have it up there, could you tell us about the metallicity effect?
Sure. Okay, so what we've been seeing that these very bright, the most luminous supernovae, the ones that aren't 2N, seem to be occurring, at least in low luminosity galaxies. And if you think about this LBV mass loss rate, we've been arguing that it's independent of metallicity. So massive stars, as they evolve at solar metallicity, they do lose some mass through stellar winds, and it's metallicity dependent. So that sort of prepares them for the LBV phase to be more unstable, and they'll eject mass over a long time period. So you might expect to get a large distribution of circumstellar material before the supernova. In a lower metallicity environment, maybe that mass loss rate is, well, it shouldn't be as efficient leading up to the LBV phase, but the LBV mass loss could still happen if you had enough of a burst to drive it off, enough of an increase. And maybe that would be, you might only get that at the very end during the late phases of core burning when something is triggered in the star. So the difference in the metallicity-dependent mass loss might have an effect on the outcome, even for the difference between 2Ns and 2Ps. Or sorry, 2Ls, whatever.
How did you measure the wind velocity for 2005 AP and 2008 ES?
That's just a guess for those. I didn't.
So does that affect their position in the diagram, and where else could they be?
They would. Where did it go? They would move along a diagonal line in that diagram. So they would be somewhere up here.
Questions?